This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Removing all of the coal ash at the Michigan City coal-fired power plant that's owned by NIPSCO, instead of keeping some in place, might create some more jobs and boost the local economy. That is according to a new report that has come out recently from the environmental nonprofit Earth Justice, and the power plant at Michigan City is included in the report. It's also part of an overall view by the group called Just Transition Northwest Indiana to bring to light some of the legacy of coal ash and local contamination here in Northwest Indiana. And with us to talk about the report from Earth Justice and what kind of impact we're talking about here, we have Ashley Williams with Just Transition Northwest Indiana with us. Ashley, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much.
We go in a little more detail here from what the organization Earth Justice wanted to look into as far as the benefits financially, economically, of properly removing and storing coal ash could be.
Yeah, so Earth Justice really wanted to make the case for a clean closure, why we should do it, the benefits to our economy, and really doing a deeper analysis of why we need to do it right. So for this report, I think it is really groundbreaking. It is unprecedented because we know, right, largely the ill effects of coal ash and why this stuff should be handled properly, why we should opt for a removal, a complete repurposing of the coal ash that's getting out of our communities. But this really looks into the economic benefits, and it shows that there are much greater economic benefits for doing this right, doing a clean closure of the coal ash, versus doing what we call a cap in place or a cap and run. With utilities, this is often what they opt for because they say it is the most economically beneficial solution. But this report actually sheds light and says the contrary to saying that actually this is why we need to do this, because it is really going to benefit and stimulate our local economy. So it's been so beneficial to really get the truth out about that and help us to really continue to pressure NIPSCO as well as other utilities within the state of Indiana and beyond.
I know that Earth Justice spread out, besides looking at the Michigan City NIPSCO facility, they looked at other facilities that are very much like it here around the country. Will you tell us a little bit more about what those are and if there are similarities that those other power plant coal plant disposal, ash disposal sites, I guess I'm trying to say, have in common here with us?
Yeah, so they looked at the Granger site in Wisconsin, which is a coal plant there. They also looked at Colstrip, Montana, and that particular plant there. And that also showed across the board that there are universally major economic benefits for why doing clean closure at those sites. So really the common thread is across the board as we looked at every single case, including Michigan City and our generating station here, you really cannot say the contrary in that there isn't massive economic benefit. This, again, showed that across the board, every single one of those coal plants showed that there were massive economic advantages. So they varied from looking at stimulating the GDP in terms of workforce and what that would look like with job creation in terms of what that would pay and so on and so forth. So this is looking across multiple classes of job creation and what that would look like within these sectors. That was really the common thread here with Granger as well as with Colstrip. With the inclusion of that report.
I know that Earth Justice spent a lot of time, obviously, in looking at all of these power plants and the coal ash ponds and the like that are connected to them in ways of figuring out what kind of economic benefit really should come from proper disposal. In particular, did they find anything interesting and put it forth in the report about the Michigan City facility? Because it's right on the edge of the city itself. It's not like connected to the city, but by a few miles, it's virtually next door.
Yeah. In terms of, what they found interesting is that with these sites, it said that it would create seven times as many jobs and add 8 million more to the area's GDP over a decade. And we thought that was incredible in comparison to what that's going to look like if they go ahead with ultimately, although they are saying it is a clean closure, it is still a cap in place because they are only partially removing, right, those five ponds that contain the coal ash on the property. But we are estimating, right, that there are 2 million tons of coal ash fill that is on the property, right, along our lakeshore that is currently seeping in. And half of that fill material, which also contains, you know, water and sand and other things, half of that is actually estimated to contain that toxic coal ash, right, that is currently leaching in and endangering our drinking water as well as our aquatic life and our environment. So we felt like with shedding light on the economic benefits, it was really interesting because we all too often are sold the falsehood that, again, this is going to be really bad for our economy and for ultimately us having to pay for this. So we're also really trying to advocate that NIPSCO is responsible for cleaning up for their mess as well as these utilities because, again, it's gonna really be an economic benefit across the board here. So we felt that was really, really interesting with the finding in the report.
We're talking with Ashley Williams, who is with the organization called Just Transition Northwest Indiana here in Northwest Indiana. It's in particular about a report that's come out from the environmental nonprofit Earth Justice. They've taken a look at a number of power generating facilities around the country, including the NIPSCO Michigan City coal-fired power plant, and finding what kind of benefit in properly handling the coal ash, which over the decades has come out of the NIPSCO plant, would have. What you could tell from the report that Earth Justice put out, what kind of responsibilities that the city of Michigan City has in all of this, as well as NIPSCO, in trying to make the neighborhoods around the power plant, as well as the entire city, a little better economically?
Yeah, so with this, we're really trying to bring this out to our local elected officials and say that, you know, they do have the responsibility to respond on this. And so we have been talking to multiple elected officials from the state to the federal level on this. So we really have been, sounding the alarm and speaking loud and clear on this. And so, you know, through this, we're really seeing that there has been a lot of support locally within our council. There is actually going to be a resolution that is introduced tonight within the Michigan City Council, actually outlining a lot of the requests that are being made in our petition that we're currently circulating that are also shown in this report and making the case for why NIPSCO needs to opt for a clean closure. We are anticipating a 2022 closure of those on-site coal ash pits. And so we're saying this needs to be included in that closure, that this closure needs to be amended to include that legacy fill. So that's what we're seeing is that they have been stepping up. This report also shows that not just with the clean closure, but also shows a report that looks at the economic benefits and different sort of redevelopment scenarios and what that could look like. So that's also something we're talking to and taking to city officials, to elected officials, as well as the community to really think about what is the future for the NIPSCO site. And that has to be decided by the community. Ultimately, that needs to come from the community. We as the community need to hold elected officials accountable. And we really see this as a toolkit. We really see this as like, this is the report we can fall back on and make the case on why they need to do this right.
Now, what does Earth Justice recommend in the report about the Michigan City facility that NIPSCO needs to do besides what they are planning to do, which we should mention? They've got coal ash in five ponds, and they were going to keep a legacy coal ash pond and a coal ash fill on site. What should they do to go beyond just that?
Yeah, so absolutely. And what they need to do is to thoroughly and fully remove not just the five coal ash ponds, but that legacy fill, the 2 million tons of legacy fill that is currently only held back by a deteriorating corroding wall that may give way at any time. Because we know the worsening climate crisis, right, is leading to rising lake levels. Right. And all of these effects that we're feeling. So it is really only a matter of time before that wall blows. So we're saying excavate, act hastily, and making sure that is included in their forthcoming CCR plan. And with that, to really think about what does it look like to fully remove all of that so we can have a vision for the Michigan City site. So we really can begin to bring our community members, those that have been most impacted on the west side here in Michigan City, all those that have suffered legacy pollution issues, so they really can have a vision for that site. If not, it's going to be a toxic waste dump, and we don't want that for our communities. We don't need that for any more of with the lakeshore and all of the crises that we've been experiencing because of these rising lake levels and erosion issues.
I know that the Hoosier Environmental Council is very concerned about this. They have been for decades in dealing with the coal ash pollution, not only in Michigan City, but at the other electrical generation sites that are in Indiana. What have they had to say, as far as you know, about this report that's come out concerning Michigan City and the others that are listed around the country from Earth Justice?
The Hoosier Environmental Council has really been instrumental in this whole process and helping actually to formulate this report. Earth Justice has been so inclusive in sitting down with us and really crafting this report, what is going to be most beneficial for you. And Earth Justice, primarily with Dr. Indra Frank, who's been absolutely phenomenal in this process, has really been helping to shape this report. So they, too, are really going to be utilizing this within their work, as they are really one of the foremost group that's leading on coal ash issues in the state. We really try to do everything we can on a larger level, but we are here in Northwest Indiana. And so they're going to be using this report as they look to other utilities, those that are fully leaving their coal ash in place, right, like Duke Energy and other utilities. And so this is going to be utilized for those forthcoming closure plans within this process and beyond. So they're really using this as a toolkit as well for their work, looking at other utilities in the state to do it right, including those four other investor-owned utilities within the state.
Now, you mentioned, Ashley, about the fact that the city council in Michigan City is going to be taking up some of these issues. They'll have a discussion about it. As far as you know, are there any other discussions, public or otherwise, that are likely to take place anytime soon in Michigan City, now that this report is out and it's time to do something more than just relying on what NIPSCO is going to do?
I think there's going to be a lot of discussions to come. Uh-huh. And really with the Michigan City resolution tonight, again, it sends a powerful message that we are not going to allow this to happen, and that through that, we're really going to lay that vision for the larger site. I think, you know, we're going door to door. We've been knocking on doors. We have an upcoming canvas in Michigan City in Town of Pines, where they disposed of 1 million tons of coal ash and contaminated the community over a process of many, many years. And so there is going to be a lot of conversation and talk as we go out into those neighborhoods, in those communities, interacting with folks safely at the door to have these conversations. And so we're looking at our state agencies, we're looking at our federal agencies and having those conversations. And so there's been a lot happening. Really, right now, we need to make sure that they're actually putting that talk to action.
Well, sounds like
you're going to see a lot. We're going to make sure that you see much more to come on that. And but there's been lots of conversations, so the time is now to really do something about it.
And there sounds like there'll be a lot more conversations, especially since this Earth Justice report has come out, and more information for people to take a look at if they choose to do so, and discuss in public meetings in Michigan City, to be sure. And Ashley, thank you very much for spending time going over the information from the report as it pertains about the Michigan City coal-fired power plant owned by NIPSCO, and we hope to hear back from you all soon about any future meetings that are coming up.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was a true pleasure. You take care.
Thank you. Ashley Williams is a member of Just Transition Northwest Indiana, which is a grassroots organization of community members and partners. The mission of the organization is to educate and organize communities and workers, giving them an opportunity to speak out about their stories and a transition to a regenerative economy here in Northwest Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana University Northwest Associate Professor of Economics Micah Pollack, of course, has a very, very popular Twitter page as he takes a very constant look at how the coronavirus is affecting Northwest Indiana, mainly from the economic viewpoint, but a lot of it I'm sure else gets in as well. And he is with us to talk about the fact that that I guess your subject matter that you've followed through on has picked up some attention on a much wider basis than just Northwest Indiana. It's shown up on a podcast, I understand. Will you tell us first about this podcast series that you're involved with IU?
Thanks for having me, Chris. Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, not surprisingly, it's not just Northwest Indiana that's interested in COVID-19 and the trends and the latest numbers. It's, you know, something that the state and nationally, even internationally, has become an important topic, obviously, in the last year and a half or so. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to have some of my analysis talked about, you know, both on an IU podcast and as well as kind of on some national and international media as well.
I know that the university likes to bring in experts from campus, faculty members and researchers and the like on a number of topics. And certainly I'm sure that they have had a number of podcasts that have brought in other experts from the School of Medicine and the like from IU into this topic in particular. What in particular did they want to seek out from you as part of your research and certainly looking look into the Delta variant?
Yeah, so there's always an economic component to, you know, when you talk about COVID-19 because, you know, it is triggering an economic crisis worldwide. And so, you know, with the rise of Delta, there's questions, will we go back into lockdown? What are going to be the long-term economic effects? And, you know, how will the nation and its economy deal in response to this new variant?
When you took a look at the information, you get a chance to look at all the figures, and even though we know we're not getting as much from the State Department of Health anymore than we have, at least in the past, the last few months anyway, what indications have you gotten lately from them, certainly more focusing on the Delta variant that is going to have the impact that you know is going to come about to the local economy as well as maybe even the state or the regional economy?
Yeah, so this current rise of the Delta cases is a little different than the beginning of the pandemic when, you know, we were also very much concerned about how it might impact the economy, because today we have the tools to deal with COVID-19. We have the vaccines. We have research on what works and what doesn't work. And so in a sense, the question is, how much are we going to take advantage of those tools, and how much are we just going to, you know, let what happened last spring happen again? I think that's kind of the heart of the issue, and it kind of ties into all this other discussion over should vaccines be mandated, should wearing face masks be mandated, what should happen with schools, and so it kind of all blends back together. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to, you know, how willing are we to try to just simply defeat this virus and end the pandemic today?
I know there has been concern, and there's still concern even from some. Unfortunately, those who have not gotten vaccinated, they have their reasons why they have not. And some of them have come about because of what's been in the news lately about the political charged nature of the virus and trying to deal with it. But what are you thinking that people should know based on what you've learned about, for example, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines? Are they still very effective? And will they be able to deal better with the Delta variant than what they have, at least with the primary variant so far, or the primary virus so far?
Yeah, so the Delta variant is a new challenge. You know, it's generally 1,000 times the viral load in your body compared to the original virus, which ends up making about twice as infectious. As far as we know, it's probably about the same level of deadliness as the original strain, although it might be a little bit more deadly specifically for older ages. But we're talking about this variant as being as infectious as chickenpox. Mm-hmm. And as this variant has risen, it's kind of forced out all the other previous variants in the original strain. Almost all the cases in Indiana of COVID-19 in the last month have been the Delta variant. So it's not like we're waiting around for it to get here. It's here. And if you or someone you know catches COVID, it's 99% chance roughly that you have caught the Delta variant. Mm-hmm. And the vaccines that we developed for the original strain continue to be effective. So close to 95% or more effective at eliminating your risk of serious illness, so being hospitalized or dying. The difference, and I think some of the controversy comes in because, you know, vaccines don't mean you cannot catch the virus, right? You're out there, you get sneezed on, you get exposed, and when you get exposed to that virus, your body mounts a defense, and the vaccines are the tools that they use to mount the defense. And because the Delta variant has such a higher viral load, it takes you a little bit longer to, you know, fight off the virus. And in that time, you might have symptoms. You could be contagious. And so that's the big difference for the Delta variant. So even though the vaccines will keep you out of the hospital, keep you from dying, they won't block the contagiousness as much as they would on an earlier strain, simply because this is just a much nastier variant. And so you get vaccinated, that's still the best thing you can do, and it's incredibly effective at preventing you from having a serious illness from the virus. But you should also be aware that it doesn't mean you can never get infected and you can never spread the virus.
It just, I guess, primarily means that the variant could cause somebody to get sick, but if they've been vaccinated, at least the likelihood of a very serious illness or worse is not quite as likely to happen, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So that, you know, if you're infected and you're vaccinated, it's a huge reduction in risk. Since the beginning of the year, 98.5%, so 98.5% of all hospitalizations have been people that were unvaccinated, and 98% of deaths have been among people that are unvaccinated. So there's always going to be a few exceptions here and there if, you know, you have a weak immune system or you're immunocompromised or something like that. But getting vaccinated is just an incredible tool at essentially eliminating your risk of a severe illness.
Now, since your primary field of study, of course, is economics, and you look very closely into the Northwest and the regional economies here, dealing with your regular matters, but when it comes to dealing with the virus, that certainly has a major impact, as we know, financially, economically in the region. Are you seeing that there is concern, at least around the region, that the Delta variant may cause some more economic problems for us here?
It's possible. You know, a lot of the challenges we faced with the original virus, you know, when it began over a year ago, might rear their heads again. You know, you may have businesses that are forced to, you know, close temporarily while, you know, their workers are quarantined. But the big difference is that we have in our hands the tools to prevent that from happening. And I understand there's a lot of controversy over requiring vaccines, but let me just point out that if you are a business and you have your employees vaccinated, the pandemic is essentially over for you, because you don't have to worry about workers, you know, needing to be quarantined or, you know, closing your business because you know, workers are sick, and it just essentially makes the pandemic go away. So we have these wonderful tools that we just need to use, and, you know, we can go back to the business as normal pre-pandemic.
Well, I guess it's just a matter then, too, just doing the common sense things of keeping things clean so that you kind of keep the virus at least at bay, and make sure that the people are protected by getting their vaccinations, just in general, so that if you have a business, you yourself as well as your employees will be safe and hopefully stay healthy that way too.
Absolutely. And if, you know, requiring a vaccine is just a little too much for you, it, you know, at least consider requiring face masks, which, you know, at worst are a minor inconvenience and have the potential to reduce the spread as well.
Indiana University Northwest Professor of Economics Micah Pollack has been looking into this, and still does, for his Twitter feed, and he has had an opportunity to talk on a recent IU podcast about the Delta variant. And thank you very much, Micah, for being with us, and we hope to hear back from you soon with more great news and great innovation that will come about here as far as looking into public health is concerned. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Every day, patients with chronic illnesses need blood transfusions. But what if the blood bank doesn't have a match? Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousri reports that some African-American patients have to wait for days.
Letitia Bryan's friends know her as the life of the party.
I have a lot of friends. I do. And they all say that. You're crazy. Like, it's just, but I just like to have fun.
She's 48. She has a pink pixie haircut. She's bedazzled with hoop earrings and colorful charm bracelets on her left wrist. The right wrist still has a hospital bracelet. She just came back from an appointment.
A person that has sickle cell anemia,
which means her red blood cells are misshapen and are more likely to clot. She's more prone to stroke and organ failure. So Bryant needs blood transfusions a few times a year. But finding the blood can be a challenge.
When you're already hurting and in pain, that makes you be uneasy, because you don't want to even think or, you know, have a situation where you can't get blood. And then knowing that you will be sicker and sicker as time goes.
Bryant does not have a blood match in Indiana, and that's mainly because she's African-American. She's also far from the only one who needs a match. Kimber Blackwell, a physician assistant at the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center, says the center has several patients who also don't have a match.
So when I see them get admitted, I start to get nervous because I know if this person needs blood, it's going to take us 2 days to get blood from a blood bank out of state to match up with them.
And 2 days is too long.
And 2 days can be too long, yeah.
She says there's a shortage in African-American blood and stem cell donors. In fact, the Red Cross says only 3% of blood donors are African-American. And that's a big problem.
So when we think of blood typing, we think of everybody being type A, type O, type AB, or type B, and then positive or negative on top of that. But then there's these minor antigens that are on the surface of the red cell.
These antigens are made of proteins and sugars, and they come in many different combinations. They differ from one person to another and from one ethnicity to another. So a black patient will likely find a better match in a pool of black donors. And that's especially crucial for patients who get frequent blood transfusions, like those with certain blood cancers or sickle cell disease. Because if they don't,
then the body can have a reaction to fight it. And that can actually make the blood cells get destroyed.
And Blackwell says that would make it even harder for some patients to receive transfusions in the future, especially with the ongoing shortage of black blood donors. This shortage has its reasons. Lack of awareness is a big one. But Amrita Myers, professor of gender and African American history at IU Bloomington, says there's also a lack of trust in the medical establishment. Blood donation and banking are tainted with a racist past.
And so even though a black doctor had helped to create the technology for blood preservation for banking purposes, there were people who didn't want a white person's donated blood going into a black person's body and vice versa. The banked blood was being kept segregated.
The Red Cross labeled blood from black donors as Negro blood back then, not based on science, but out of racism. Some black Americans were even turned away from donating blood during events like World War II and Pearl Harbor.
Please avoid excessive heavy bending, lifting, pushing, or pulling with this arm because it could result in a bruise, okay?
Blood donation booths like this one at the Indiana Black Expo is one way some blood centers are trying to raise awareness and build trust. The booth belongs to Versity Blood Center, and it's staffed with an all-black nurse and technician crew.
Do you have a band-aid that you want to...
Just keep the pressure on them.
Oh, okay.
Adam Richardson is scared of needles. He doesn't usually donate blood, yet somehow he sits at this booth with a needle in his arm. He's African-American, and he sees there's only one other person donating, a Caucasian man.
You know, I would have felt bad if they only have one or two, you know, I mean...
He waits as a half-liter bag is filled with his blood and is assured by what the nurse tells him that his donation will help save lives. Farah Yusri, Side Effects Public Media.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. On tomorrow's program, we will have a conversation with financial advisor and student economics expert Brian Walsh. He has some tips to help parents and students be able to pay for college. We hope you can join us.